You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station. The BFM Breakfast Grill. Top interviews you can't afford to miss. Presented by the CIMB Group.
This morning, we welcome Daud Vickery Abdullah, the President and Chief Executive of the International Centre for Education and Islamic Finance, otherwise known as INSEAF. Daud, welcome to the Breakfast Grill. Now, your organisation was set up in 2005 by Bank Negara. 8 years into the gig, where are you in terms of, you know, student enrolment and teaching body?
Well, thank you for that warm introduction. Yes, we're 8 years into our transformation. When we started in 2005, we didn't have any programs, so we spent 2006 working out the educational programs that we wanted to be in. And in 2007, we took our first intake of students into a master's professional qualification. 32 people joined us. Today, 7 years on from that, we have over 2,200 students from 84 countries around the world, 70% of whom are with us online.
Okay. And the funding for the exercise at the time of the institution was a 600 million ringgit endowment from Bank Negara. That, of course, means that you don't use that capital. You operate on the interest that that rises from it, which is currently to the tune of about 24 million ringgit a year. Now, you know, in the years that have, you know, and the water that's passed under the bridge since then, Daud, you know, how has the money been spent, and basically what's been the ROI for the industry?
Right. Firstly, I need to correct you that we don't get interest on it because it's invested Islamically, so we get a profit share on it. But those kind of numbers are numbers of there. But basically, we're very grateful for having that endowment fund, and it covers probably today less than 50% of our operational expenses. And the largest aspect of that, of course, is paying for our faculty. So the rest we need to make up by actually selling our programs. So our work in terms of taking on student numbers, in terms of doing executive programs, which we charge for, in terms of doing research, and in terms of doing, as I mentioned, executive programs and building on knowledge management, all of which we charge for, helps us to bridge that gap. If we're not relevant to the industry, then we're not able to sell those programs. So the return on investment has to be an increasing relevance of INSEAF in providing good quality human capital to the industry, not only here in Malaysia, but as I mentioned, over 80 countries send their students to us. We have to have a global relevance as well.
Before we get into the current key result areas for INSEAF, Daud, what's really been the ROI, the return for, you know, the Sharia finance industry, not just locally but globally as well, in the 6 or 7 years since inception?
Well, I think, you know, in those years, I mean, you need to look at some of the important metrics. You know, the largest number or the most visible number is the $1.8 trillion of assets globally, but that still only represents about 1% of global assets. If you look at Malaysia specifically, then about 26% of the banking system is done Islamically. Over 60% of the capital market is done Islamically. So it's made great strides in the last 7, 8, 10 years. However, you've got to get a sense of perspective on where Islamic finance sits on the global basis. It's still relatively small, but it is growing fast and attracting a great deal of attention.
And of course, INSEAF being a key component to that, contributing to that number, but not entirely, Daud. In terms of the key result areas, you've got three clear areas. Number one is academic excellence. Number two, to build a global reputation with stakeholders. And number three, to have financial sustainability. Taking the first point right now, academic excellence, to the layperson, it seems quite an ephemeral objective. Can you flesh it out for us?
Yeah, I mean, academic excellence, we do need to get grounded on what that really means. I mean, this is not just the quality of the programs and the quality of the faculty, but how well recognized the degrees are that we produce and how we're actually internationally accredited. Within Malaysia, we have accreditation, of course, from the Ministry of Education in terms of our academic programs. But from a professional standpoint, we are now going for international accreditation with something called the AACSB, which effectively the major business schools of the world are aligned to, like Harvard Business School, London School of Economics, INSEAD, Hong Kong Business School, and so on. We've been accepted into that program, and we're now going through a detailed accreditation process for the next 2 to 5 years.
If and when you do get accreditation, you would be the second university in Malaysia after University Putra Malaysia. Now, that's a bit bizarre, because University of Putra Malaysia does not roll off the tongue as easily as Harvard Business School when it comes to business accreditation.
Well, it's actually their business school which has been accredited, and no, it doesn't. But effectively, they've gone through and passed the same standards. For us at INSEF, it means international recognition and that we've been vetted against the same standards which the best business schools have been vetted against. So it really does give a clear indication to both international students and to bodies that we're dealing with in the international forum that we are up to, you know, world-class standards, that we're actually benchmarked against the best standards in terms of our faculty, our program, the content, the learning outcomes, and so on.
And onto the second KRA, which is to build a global reputation with stakeholders. These really are based on partnerships. You know, discuss.
Well, I think there's a large part of it is based on partnerships. And I think, like, you know, individuals, you judge a man by the company he keeps. INSEF in the last 2 years has developed strategic partnerships with the World Bank, with the Islamic Financial Services Board, with the Islamic Development Bank, as well as a number of international players like Kuwait Finance House, BNP Paribas. And this helps us raise our profile, but it's also a recognition that they feel that we have something to offer. The World Bank looks at INSEF as a technical resource for research in terms of Islamic finance. And through the World Bank partnership, for example, we were able to deliver an executive program in Washington earlier this year on the eve of the annual spring meeting of the IMF to explain the role of Islamic finance in global economic development. And that gives you an example of the sort of reputation that we're trying to build. Clearly, we also need to build reputation with students and with alumni. We need to attract world-class faculty to our facility, and we need to have a reputation with the industry itself, which says we believe that INSEF is actually engaged in the right kind of research, it's producing the right kind of output in terms of its students, and we would like to pay a premium in order to, you know, to purchase these students, if you like, give them a job later on.
And the third leg of your KRA is, doubt, is the fact that you've got to aim for financial sustainability. Now, of course, this means attracting endowments, and of course attracting endowments is really is based on your capabilities, your accreditation, your credibility, and so on and so forth. How are you doing on this front?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely correct that all of these things are closely linked, that you don't attract funding into the university unless you've actually got good academic standards and that you have a strong reputation. We're doing pretty well, but we've obviously got more work to do. In my past life, as you're aware, I've run a bank, and therefore the balance sheet and the modus operandi of the profit and loss account is somewhat different to running a university, and we take a longer term view on this. But with the generosity from Bank Negara Malaysia with the initial endowment fund, we have a sound platform, and we've had some good contributions from both local and international entities who have contributed not only to scholarships for students, but also have funded some of our classrooms. We now need to build and grow on that in order over the next 3 to 5 years ensure that we have a stable financial platform from which to grow. I mean, if I can give a striking example, Harvard University in the United States, which has been around a couple of hundred years, has an endowment fund of something like $36 billion. Compare that with our 600 million ringgit, there's a huge difference, and we therefore have some way to go in order to build up a sustainable future.
Well, you know, this, I know you can't discuss identities and names of the institutions that have contributed, but, you know, is there an ideal number 10 years out that you might perhaps strike forward and attain?
What, in terms of the number of the endowment fund? Yeah, I mean, I think a reasonable number that which will see us crossing the threshold would be
into full sustainability, I suppose, you know, the half OPEX right
yeah,
now.
Would be a billion ringgit. Would be a basis. That would be an initial target. But I'm not saying let's stop there. We actually need to go on, because the more we have, the more we can open our doors to students who are less fortunate through scholarships, and we can actually build and strengthen the quality of faculty and our delivery mechanisms.
So 6 or 7 years into inception, Daud, you know, what's been the central bank and essentially Tan Sri Zeti's appreciation of INSEF's work done thus far? I mean, where are the areas that she might feel INSEF might need to put, you know, forge more forward on?
Well, I think that's a question you probably need to ask the governor directly, but I certainly have a strong sense of two things. One is she and Bank Negara are very actively involved in this with us in terms of their commitment to our board and to our steering groups and governing council. They put a huge amount of time and energy into helping us, you know, engage in our strategy. But I think probably the most important thing is that we've become sustainable in the sense that we've now got a global reach. The fact that we started with 32 students from 7 countries and we're now at 2,200 from 84 countries is a big indication that we're headed in the right direction and have global appeal.
This morning we talked to Daud Vickery Abdullah, the President and Chief Executive of the International Centre for Education and Islamic Finance, otherwise known as INSEF. After this, Daud, the Sharia finance industry both locally and in Malaysia.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
This morning, Daud Vickery Abdullah, the President and CEO of the International Centre for Education and Islamic Finance, otherwise known as INSEF, is with us on The Breakfast Call this morning. Daud, I must correct myself earlier. I did say locally and in Malaysia. I meant locally as well as abroad, where Sharia obviously is making great headway. From the Malaysian standpoint, though, initially, Daud, we do understand that obviously we've done a quite a big deal from a Sharia standpoint in terms of, you know, value of Sharia versus conventional and in terms of total issuances as well. But, you know, from a banking standpoint, where clearly conventional products might be more profitable for banks versus an Islamic product, which might be slightly more expensive in terms of pricing, is, you know, from a framework standpoint, does this make the regulators push to make Islamic finance more palatable, a harder job?
I think that's a complex question, and I have to frame my answer on the basis of two things. One is that I'm no longer a practitioner. It's about 6 years.
Of course, you used to head up Hong Kong Islamic Bank, so you have both.
I used to, yeah. But the currency of the numbers is somewhat different. And I think the other aspect is that you're taking a look at, from the point of view of the regulator, and I'm not a regulator, but I do have an opinion on this, that I think it's an increasingly challenging market in the retail space, and therefore most people have a price point. In other words, customers are actually looking at the pricing, and therefore it's incumbent on Islamic finance to demonstrate that it can be price competitive, but also develop greater value propositions for the consumer. And that means constant challenges between, you know, pricing mechanisms between Islamic and conventional, and I'm not engaged in that day-to-day, you know, for the last 6 years, but I would imagine there are some pretty challenging meetings within many of the banks here about the pricing strategy and also about the clustering of products, because remember, it's not just about selling one product, it's about using a product to attract people to come and buy other products. So you're looking at the bundling and the overall bundling and pricing strategy there. But no doubt about it, in the retail space, it's challenging to remain price competitive, because at the end of the day, that is the prime driver for most of the customer base.
From a layperson's standpoint, such as myself, it does seem to be that the central conundrum for banks is that the two areas seem to be diametrically opposing. For example, in conventional banking, the risk is very much laid at the doorstep of the borrower, and he or she is heavily punished when he or she defaults in his loan. Whereas in Islamic finance, it's really based on the real economy. There's a lot of moral issues attached to it, and of course, there's an altruism attached to that product. And that calls for banks to be slightly schizophrenic in that viewpoint. Do you agree?
Well, I think schizophrenia is an interesting choice of terminology, and I'm not sure I agree or disagree, but I do understand that there are some significant differences. On the one hand, you do have a risk-shifting environment within conventional finance, where effectively you try to move the risk, you know, down the line, and sadly, sometimes the person least able to bear the risk gets penalized. The concept in Islamic finance is a basis of risk-sharing. However, if you're going to risk-share, all parties need to be fully aware of what the risks are that they're taking. So it actually does come back to education, and not just education at an INSEF level where you're educating the leadership or the practitioners, but also at a general population level, that there are alternative mechanisms out there which have some basis of appeal in terms of developing the real economy and in terms of developing, you know, more of a risk-sharing environment. So education would be key.
Daud Vickery Abdullah, the President and Chief Executive of INSEF, which is the International Centre for Education and Islamic Finance, with us on The Breakfast Call this morning. Daud, in terms of Malaysia, where of course we have made quite a lot of headway in terms of Sharia products, where it's been where it's been taken a little bit further, for example, with the Dana Infra retail bond, for example, which suffered a bit of a lukewarm response at 0.61 times subscription. Do you think the learning curve has flattened somewhat?
I'm not so sure it's the learning curve. I think the learning curve needs to go on and be sustained, but I think you've got to look at market conditions, and you're picking on one particular example there. You know, market conditions locally and globally do fluctuate. You know, we saw a huge downfall in the amount of Sukuk issuance and take-up, not just as a result of the crisis, but also by some uncertainty about Sharia pronouncements a number of years ago. I think the market has picked up, and I think people, the market is actually looking at individual issues much more critically because they need to, they understand more of the questions they should be asking. So I think there's sustainable growth, and I think it will continue, but I think we need to be very aware of the market conditions and very aware of the details surrounding each particular issuance.
I mean, certainly from a policy standpoint, the framework and the environment seems very accommodative. And I'd like to cite the Islamic Financial Services Act, effective July 1st, which has given insurance companies a five-year period in which to split their conventional and takaful businesses. That seems like quite a long time frame, but at the same time, it does allow for a lot of real and serious work to be done in terms of doing it properly. What's your view on this legislation?
Well, my view is on that particular aspect of the legislation, 5 years is actually not that long. And if you're trying to, demonstrate complete transparency, a transformation period of 5 years will be quickly eaten up. I think what is important around this legislation, and I see it from a global perspective, is that it demonstrates Malaysia is actually building this business, is committed to building a global Islamic finance marketplace, and has the right supportive legislation in order to develop it further. So I think that, medium to long term, I view it very, very positively, but clearly a lot of, grey matter is going to be applied by individual insurance companies or takaful companies and financial conglomerates in order to take advantage of it and to figure out their strategies in order to maintain market share or indeed to grow it.
Daud, in our past discussions on Sharia finance, we've also talked on, you've also highlighted the importance of the joint development of both sides of banking, conventional as well as in Sharia. And unfortunately, KL continues to be a minor hitter on the global financial stage. Singapore and Hong Kong clearly outrank KL. Is this a big hindrance to, Malaysia's Sharia aspirations?
I don't see it as a big hindrance. I see it more as an opportunity. Undoubtedly, you're absolutely correct. I mean, Malaysia has built up a capability as a global Islamic finance marketplace. The expertise is here. It is a central market, and there are many reasons for that, and now's not the time to go into it, but it's done remarkably well. However, on the conventional side, it is not known as a conventional marketplace. And therefore, when you're looking at the experience of that marketplace, it's going to be a challenge to build that up quickly. And there's no particular aspirations that I'm aware of that the KL market is looking to take on Hong Kong or Singapore from a conventional standpoint. However, from an Islamic standpoint, there is everything going for it, and therefore there is a need, shall we say, for the conventional side to complement what's happening in the Islamic finance space. So I think it takes time. I think there is the necessary focus there, and there is the will to make the changes. But it's going to be very much a case of everybody, all hands to the pump, everybody contributing.
Well, when you put Malaysia and the rest of the world side by side, there does seem to be a two-speed approach to Sharia finance. Malaysia at 26% of conventional banking assets versus conventional banking assets. Clearly, a lot of headway has been made, but on a global basis, just 1%. So obviously, Malaysia is moving at a lot quicker rate than the rest of the world. And that's the conundrum for Sharia practitioners such as yourself, because although a lot of attention's been heaped on Sharia finance heretofore, it hasn't made much of an impact. I mean, what's your view?
Well, I think it has made an impact, but I agree with you, the differentiation in the numbers. Malaysia has particularly focused on building Islamic finance. Other countries, and if you look at the Western world, there's been no particular motivation until quite recently for them to engage in this, other than the fact that they now see the 1% as a critical mass. And if you look at the London market, for example, London for the last several years, and particularly the last year or so, is now very focused on building up its Sharia capabilities and sees Islamic finance as an important platform. They've created a UK Islamic Finance Task Force in order to focus on how they can build up London's reputation in Islamic finance in all aspects of what we're talking about. It's not just Sharia, it's about product, it's about education, it's about risk management, it's about the legal framework and so on. And so there is interest there, and I think you will see a rapid growth in many Western markets, which start to, I won't say embrace Islamic finance, but see it as a viable alternative, which has a role to play in the global financial equation.
Well, truth be told, London has been an ardent student of Islamic finance for quite a number of years now. And the big takeaway from the global financial crisis of 2008 is the fact that the non-real economy, such as the derivatives and the warrants and all the other exotic products that ensued as a result of taking on, you know, highly risky loans, were outside of the tenets of Islamic finance. But it does appear that where the global financial industry is going, that not many lessons have been learned, and we continue to make the same kind of mistakes. Is that a view that you share?
I think there's always this loop around where everybody does a lot of naval contemplation, as I call it, you know, immediately after the crisis, and then the same habits start to come back. And I think there are worrying signs that the same thing is happening. However, there are also encouraging signs that people are looking at, in markets around the world, at the viability of Islamic finance and perhaps learning from some of the mistakes. But it's very, very easy to sort of fall back into the old bad habits. Very often, and I believe in the old adage of you can't manage what you can't measure. You know, if the metrics are set in a way where individuals or teams or corporations are set to, you know, maximize profits at all costs, then you're going to get the same kind of results. But if people are saying, well, let's do sustainable growth, let's look at reasonable levels of profit, but actually we're doing this on more of a social responsibility basis, but still profitably, then attitudes can change. But a lot of work has to be done to change those attitudes.
Well, Dan, could that be the biggest obstruction to global adoption of Islamic finance? Because you're talking about an approach to finance which, you know, which for hundreds of years, if not thousands, has been one which has been based, predicated on profit maximization, you said in your own words, whereas Islamic finance is all about, you know, risk sharing and, the prohibition of interest, for example.
Yeah. I mean, it's not so much the prohibition of risk interest, it's more about the risk sharing, and there's nothing in Islamic finance says that you can't make profits or shouldn't make profits. It's just how those profits are distributed and how they're used. And I agree with you. It's a lot easier to go down the path of greed than one of sustainability, but it's actually something that we've got to work on because, there's no gas left in the tank, as it were. If we have another global financial crisis in the next 12 months or so, then we're going to be in serious, very serious trouble. And therefore, I think it's incumbent on everybody to start thinking about how do we get the balance right? How do we actually return to a basis of more equality, transparency, and fairness?
Dal, we're almost out of time, but last question, in terms of the opportunity going forward, Asia, where many of the world's Muslims are based and resident in, it's a big opportunity because we now have the opportunity to really forge the way ahead. What's the scale of the potential here?
Well, I think the scale is very, very large. I mean, you're right that there's a huge Muslim population in Asia. In fact, it's the largest part of the world where the majority of Muslims live. But it's not just about a Muslim population. I think it's about growing economies as well of India and China and Southeast Asia, as well as Central Asia. A lot of potential for growth in terms of infrastructure, project financing, and which lends itself very nicely to the engagement with Islamic finance. So I think it comes from both sides, a Muslim population, but also the overall population and economic development and the role that Islamic finance can play to sustain and grow that development.
Dawood, highly instructional and highly informative talking to you. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
That was Dawood Vikri Abdullah, the President and Chief Executive of the International Center for Education and Islamic Finance, otherwise known as INCF, BFM 89.9.
The BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by the CIMB Group, Southeast Asia's leading universal bank. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.